So yesterday, we talked about the need for all of us to push against the idol of romance, for single Christians to open-handedly discern as a way of receiving the gift that God knows is best for us, and as an antidote to maybe any entitlement or resentment we may be experiencing. But regardless of our calling, of our gifting, a lot of us are still struggling with loneliness, right? Whether you're single or married, you feel alone more often than you think you should. So why are we so lonely? And what can we do about it? Well, there's lots of theories. Rodney Clapp's book, Families at the Crossroads, argues that the Industrial Revolution caused the breakdown of community. You know, kind of with technological advances, more Americans could afford single-family homes. And to move cities or to move states frequently. But we never asked whether we should move into single-family homes, whether we should change cities, change states, just because we could. Constant relocation destroyed hard-earned, slowly built community. Single-family homes put distance between neighbors. After work and sleep, little time is left for community, and many of those hours have to be spent cooking and doing dishes and folding laundry and getting ready for work and bed and transitioning between activities. So in multifamily homes, these mundane moments could be shared with neighbors, with people you share a home with. But in single family homes, they became lost opportunities for connection. And I've seen this play out in my own life. After college, I was a part of four different houses with vague aspirations of intentional Christian community, but each kind of fell apart because guys got married, moved for a job, or ran away from conflict. And every time I connected deeply with people in healthy ways, only for that connection to be torn apart, I was injured. You know, it hurt. And I know I'm probably not the only one who has struggled to find lasting friendship, lasting community. Daniel Groth tracks something similar in his book, The Power of Place. He argues that modern loneliness and the breakdown of community stem from several cultural and societal shifts. Yes, moving for jobs, educational or personal preferences has weakened community ties. Western culture prioritizes self-reliance, personal fulfillment, autonomy over communal bonds, this mindset discourages people from investing in long-term interdependent relationships within a stable community. But there are some uniquely modern drivers as well. While digital communication connects people across distances, it often replaces deep embodied relationships. Online interactions can create a false sense of connection, while physical presence and shared life rhythms, essential for real community, they diminish. And our modern economy encourages people to treat places and churches and relationships as transactional, like commodities. Instead of committing to a community, we shop around for the best option, leading to shallow relationships and an inability to weather difficulties together, lose connections in our churches, in our communities. And at the same time, participation in institutions of connection and service and stable belonging like churches and civics groups and local organizations has sharply declined throughout the U.S., Christian or not. So as a result, instead of societies filled with families and communities spanning multiple generations, providing wisdom and care and continuity, young adults today often live far from extended family, losing crucial relational support systems. So what can we do about it? Well, we may not be able to reverse the Industrial Revolution. We may not want to, but there are still powerful tools at our disposal. And we're going to explore some of those today. So we can reclaim a biblical imagination for deep friendship. We can cultivate meaningful friendships, in particular between singles and married parents. And we can build thicker experiences of community among the body of Christ more broadly. So that's where we're going today. So the first one, unfortunately, Christians are out of the habit of and have lost an imagination for deeper friendship, a deeper friendship that we all need. But thankfully, the scriptures and much of Christian history offer us a solution. Many of the mothers and fathers of our faith depended on what's called spiritual friendship to sustain their ministry. David and Jonathan, Ruth and Naomi, Jesus and John, Paul and Timothy. For centuries, early Christians continued this practice of committed friendship, of chosen family, of spiritual kinship. And some of these individuals were in opposite sex marriages outside of these deep friendships. Some of them were single, but both cultivated this non-sexual committed friendship, and we're going to call that spiritual friendship. Here's how Ruth speaks about her friendship with Naomi in Ruth 1 chapter, oh excuse me, we read that earlier. So you've already heard how Ruth in chapter 1 verses 16 through 18 speaks about her friendship, and we'll come back to that. Here's how David talks about his friendship with Jonathan. Sorry, I'm getting it mixed up. Here's how Jonathan talks about his friendship with David in 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 4. It says, quote, "After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David, because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off his robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic, even his sword, his bow, and his belt." And here's David in 1 Samuel 20, verse 41. Quote, "David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face on the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most." Now, we have no reason to believe that any of these men or women were same-sex attracted. No reason to believe that what we're hearing here in the scriptures is some secret homoerotic declarations. This kind of spiritual friendship, chosen family, spiritual kinship between people of the same sex was common through a lot of recorded history. And I'm particularly struck by Ruth's words that we heard read to us earlier. Quote, "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." It reminds me of Valentine's sayings like, "I am yours, and you are mine." And we think of that sentiment as being reserved for something sexual, right? But Ruth here, and all of these spiritual friendships, are reminding us that we are all made for friendships where we can also say, "I am yours." Not in a way that competes with a spouse, if we have one, or in a way that competes with our relationship with Jesus, but actually in a way that builds up both of those. So here's my big on-theme idea for today. Don't be afraid of making friends who say, "I am yours." Because it might be exactly what your loneliness and your relationship with Jesus needs. Okay, so if spiritual friendship is so great, why don't we already have them? Well, I think many of us are afraid of being known and then being rejected. We don't trust others to love us as well as we think we're going to love them. We don't want to need others, and we don't want to owe others anything. At least in a marriage, there's some level of commitment that reduces these fears and makes it easier to be vulnerable, easier to invest in one another, easier to be needy in healthy ways. But many of us come to believe that the whole point of friendship is that there isn't commitment, is that there isn't expectation, is that there isn't obligation, right? There's also practical barriers to spiritual friendship. People live alone. People live far away. We want the freedom to change our friends and churches and cities as often as we want to. But what if we cultivated these kinds of friendships? What if we let ourselves need others and gave others permission to ask of our time and energy? What if we didn't hide from our friends, but instead were vulnerable and pushed ourselves to trust them? What if we expected to get hurt and committed to forgive? Practically, those in spiritual friendships, they can treat each other like chosen family. So they can go on vacation or even live together. They can choose to sacrifice money and time and location and job and even other friends to prioritize these spiritual friendships. These friendships were enough to sustain those who were single in the scriptures and in the early church, and they were a hearty supplement for those who were married. So to learn more, I particularly encourage you to check out the book Spiritual Friendship by Wesley Hill and some other related literature and resources out there. And you can start small, okay? You don't have to start by making grand David, Jonathan, Ruth, Naomi declarations right out the gate. You know, maybe there's a friendship in your life that means a lot to you, but your get-togethers have become a little bit more sporadic. What if you started hanging out on a weekly basis to get some more consistent time together? Maybe you're not ready to make where you go, I will go commitments to a friend, but you could start by regularly checking in with one another and making them a priority in your life in some small ways at first. Then in the meantime, how can we borrow from spiritual friendship to cultivate and enjoy thicker, more life-giving connection with lots of people in our lives? Well, in particular, I want to talk about friendship between single people and between married people with kids. Because I think this community has such a healthy mix of single and marrieds, and there's a specific dynamic between those. And I've seen that in my life. I've personally seen kind of the challenges and the beauty of friendship between singles and married parents. So one of my closest friends after college was a guy named Chase. And for a season, he even considered committing to vocational singleness and helping build the intentional Christian community with me that I now live in. But eventually, he discerned that he was called to marriage. And he got married, and a few years later, he and his wife started having kids. And all that was a big adjustment for me. You know, to be honest, there was a season when I had to mourn what I felt like I had lost. Chase was absolutely being faithful to his calling. And because of the scarcity of this world, him stepping into what he was called to meant he had less time and energy available for our friendship. That time and energy only became more scarce once Chase and Hannah had young kids to care for, and I quickly realized that I wanted to be a part of their lives, but if I wanted to, I was going to need to kind of be willing to work with the less flexibility that they had, and I was going to need to be willing to work with that without resentment. That was really key. You know, if I wanted to spend consistent time with their family, I needed to be willing to slip into their rhythms, to go over after they put their kids to bed or as they're putting their kids to bed, to help them with dinner and putting their kids to bed. I had to learn how to feed and burp and diaper so that I could pitch in and seamlessly be part of the team. And I had to be okay with being bad at each of those at first. Because there's only so much you can learn from YouTube videos. Your youngest kid is a boy, he's my godson, and I just heard these terrifying stories of changing a boy's diaper and him peeing in your face. And I can't tell you how many YouTube videos I watched for like, what to do with the diaper to shield myself. Anyway, I never got peed on, so it worked out. But yeah, I've accompanied them to the grocery store, helped them fold laundry, taken the initiative to do the dishes, offered to babysit, picked up medicines from the pharmacy, helped Chase keep the kids occupied while Hannah could get some alone time. And in the small groups we've been a part of, I've had to accept that kid dinner sleep schedules will mean that Saturday and Sunday afternoons are more likely than kind of a weeknight 7 p.m. slot that I'd prefer. On the flip side, Chase and Hannah had to be willing to let me into the mess of their house, into the mess of their marriage, to not be afraid to fight in front of me, or to be in a bad mood with each other and not resolve it yet. They had to be willing to trust me with their kids and with their kids' needs, both practical and emotional. They had to invite me into their lives and in some ways make me a priority alongside the handful of other priorities they already had, and they were already overstretched by in many ways. So these days I get breakfast with Chase every Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. before we go to work. I hang out with my godson, Bentley, their eldest, for about an hour every Wednesday while his mom and the younger siblings go to like a music class down the block. And then I have kind of a standing Sunday brunch invitation at their house afterwards. So that's what it looks like for me. But it'll look different for you. But whatever the specifics are for the friendships between singles and married parents in your life, I think we're all going to have to push against the temptation to throw a pity party for ourselves, that we can't have everything we want on our terms. You know, singles are going to have to be okay with pitching in with cooking and cleaning and laundry and dishes and shopping and chores. It's probably going to look like showing up at our on the kids' schedules and showing up in emergencies. But in exchange, it can also involve allowing those kids and parents to be connected to us and to love us deeply in ways that are different than our single friends. And married, you're going to need to invite your single friends to be a part of your lives. You know, too often I think singles feel like we're imposing. So remind us that you want us in your life. Even if the logistics are complicated and you have to rain check or reschedule often, keep at it. Invite us into your homes, not just for special occasions, but for the mundane, boring things. Give us a seat at the table and let us truly be a part of your world. Perhaps, though, some of you are single and have started to build some of these spiritual friendships and some of these friendships between singles and married people in your life, but you wish you had something even more lived in and permanent. Remember earlier when I shared about my four failed attempts at attentional community, you know, eventually I realized that what I needed was something more permanent. I knew that I was made for consistent, intimate family that is physically and emotionally present. So back in, I guess it was 2018, 10 of us who were, 10 of us in Nashville who were open to long-term singleness and intentional Christian community gathered for 6 months for weekly meals to hang out and to ask God whether he was calling any of us to start an intentional Christian community, a kind of modern monastery. And by the end of that 6 months, two of us started the Nashville Family of Brothers. Fast forward to today, over the last 7 years, we've had anywhere from two guys to seven guys in our house. Right now there's four of us. The Nashville Family of Brothers is an ecumenically Christian monastery building family in Nashville, lifelong family, for men called to vocational singleness. We're still a part of our local churches. We've got jobs outside of the brotherhood that are leveraged for the sake of the kingdom, and we're still connected to parents and their kids. And right now there are four of us who pray and eat and vacation and live together in a home as a family as we discern how God is calling us to leverage our singleness for the sake of the kingdom and discern whether God is calling us to make lifetime commitments to vocational singleness and to this family. Now, I'm not expecting you to go and start a monastery unless you feel called to that, and then definitely talk to me because I'd love to talk about that. But I think there's also a much more organic, less complicated version of intentional Christian community that you guys could cultivate. Just find three other people willing to live in an apartment or a house together and commit to celibacy for a year and do simple prayer together once a day. Confess to each other once a week. Do two meals together a week. Maybe serve in your neighborhood or extended community once a month. Go on vacation together. Do one of the big holidays together. Maybe read a book about discernment or about intentional Christian community. Celebrate your kingdom work successes together and mourn loneliness together. You don't have to do all of those, but gather some people, do some of that stuff for a year, and see what happens. You never know. Okay, so we've explored how to cultivate spiritual friendships, how singles and married parents can navigate the complexities of their friendships, how singles can cultivate intentional Christian communities for themselves. I want to close with some simple suggestions for how we can use some of these ideas to build kind of a broader experience of belonging in the body of Christ. You know, among this broader Asbury community, how can we foster thicker belonging? Well, you can establish rhythms of gathering together for weekly meals or prayer among people who go to a variety of churches. I highly encourage you to schedule consistent times together, you know, brunch potlucks every Sunday, a recurring watch party for a favorite TV show, a weekly board game night, regular book discussion groups, recurring accountability spaces. Be creative and schedule regular times to do mundane, unavoidable life stuff together, like doing laundry together, or going grocery shopping, or exercising, or doing yard work. And you can even make plans to do holidays together. And I know that some of you guys tuning in aren't a part of this community in person in this season. Perhaps you'd even prefer to be cultivating embodied friendship, right? But for now, you have to make the best of virtual friendship. And my hunch is you're already making an effort to connect here with people in Wilmore and other people scattered throughout the globe. So keep it up. And particularly, those of you guys who are on campus, who have friends, who can't be with us in person in this season, what would it look like for you to be intentional about scheduling regular Zoom hangouts with them? Get creative with book discussions or virtual watch parties, or cook the same recipe and enjoy the fruits of your labors together, but from a distance. Whether you go all in and cultivate some Ruth and Naomi or David and Jonathan friendships in the near future, whether you lean into the beautiful complexity of friendship between singles and married parents, or whether you pitch in towards intentional Christian community, I want you to remember, don't be afraid of making friends who say, "I am yours," because it might be exactly what your loneliness and your relationship with Jesus needs. And ultimately, building loving friendship, I want to encourage you to build loving friendship because it shares the gospel. In John 13, verses 34 through 35, Jesus commands us to love one another, and he says that our love for one another will be what makes it obvious to people that we are a part of Jesus' family. You know, like this love is supposed to be our calling card. And Jesus wants us to love each other so well that people will want to get to know the Savior who makes it all possible. So, make deep friendships for your own sake and be encouraged. That love can share the gospel. So before you leave today, what if you sent a message to someone you care about or invited someone to dinner? What if you made plans to show up for someone, even if only in a small way at first? And let's start reclaiming the deep friendships that we were made for. Thank you, guys.